Let me now introduce Kristen Heilmann, who recently started as a curator of contemporary art and department head of the Baltimore Museum of Art. She was previously associate curator here at the Hirschhorn Museum, and her last project was indeed the exhibition of Android Perception and Reflection. At the Hirschhorn, she organized one-person direction shows of the works of Tsai Kwo Chang, 2004 and 5, Jim Hodges, 2005 and 6, Oliver Herring, 2006, worked on the show The Cinema Effect, Illusion, Reality, and the Moving Image, 2008, where she was one of the co-curators, and this was two-part extraordinary exhibition. She has done many collection installations, and one of the last one was Strange Bodies, figurative work from the Hirschhorn collection. Kristen's interest in Android extends to her seeing the work for the first time here in Washington in Baltimore Museums in 1990s, and she began planning on this exhibition in 2005. Kristen, thank you for being with us.
Hello, thanks everyone for coming tonight, and thank you, Milena. I didn't know about the coffee, so I'll do water. Tonight's talk is, as Milena said, titled Arriving at an Art Historical Antruit. As that title signals, rather than focusing on the story of Truitt's evolution as an artist, I would like to make this an exercise in contextualizing Truitt's work within the story of 20th century American reduced geometric abstraction, or if you will, minimal, with a small m, abstraction. My presentation doesn't claim to come to any firm conclusions about Truitt's place in this relatively recent and still evolving art history, but rather seeks to raise some questions about it. Among them, the question of why her work was, if not excluded, then marginalized within the discourse of minimal abstraction during the greater portion of her mature career, which extended from 1961 to 2004. This question, I think, is the proverbial elephant in the room. Among the range of answers to it is the possibility that Truitt's work is inherently something less than the work of better-known artists such as Donald Judd, Dan Flavin, Solo Witt, or Carl Andre, as well as the possibility that the art world elevates artists and their work due to factors that are external to rather than intrinsic to the artwork itself, and that minimal abstraction is particularly open to the whimsies of contextualization, whether it be discursive or economic. As the organizer of an exhibition celebrating Truitt's work, I prefer the latter explanation. Anyway, to make that topic manageable for our time together this evening, I'd like to narrow down my inquiry to one framed by the comparison of Truitt's art to two works that could be said to define a chronology of minimal abstraction that coincides with the beginning and end points of Truitt's 40-year career. And you see on the screen, on the left, or on your left, Donald Judd's Untitled from 1963, and on the right, Byron Kim's Synecdoche from 1991 to the present. It's a work that continues to grow. And this, in fact, is a new acquisition at the National Gallery, where it is currently very dramatically installed in the East Wing, and I hope you get a chance to see it. Below these two works, you see a grouping of works from the exhibition, the Antruit exhibition, and these works range from 1997 to 2004, and just as an aside, the sort of creamy yellow piece that you see at the far right, which is titled Evensong, is the final sculpture that Truitt produced before her death in December 2004 at the age of 83. Okay, let's move forward. So let's start with Truitt and Judd. You're now looking at a selection of works that Truitt produced in 1962 and 63 alongside the early Judd sculpture from 1963. And I'd like to call your attention to the red on red form, Truitt's red on red form that is in the middle of the grouping. And this is Truitt's Valley Forge from 1963. Both Valley Forge and Judd's Untitled can be described as sculptural investigations of rectilinear shape and the color red. Both are hand-painted and both bear some relationship to the dimensions of the human body. Judd's piece has the kind of domestic scale of a table, and Truitt's 96 inch wide sculpture stands just below human height, as if it were functioning like a wall or a barrier of some sort. I should also address the immediately apparent differences. Truett activates her composition through variation in the color of her paint. Judd activates his by the juxtaposition of different materials, metal, pipe, and painted wood, and the relationship between positive and negative space. All in all, though, one can certainly understand why someone who is not a student of 20th century art history might say that based on the available visual evidence, that is the objective qualities of the two pieces, that they are more similar than unlike. So why did the art world come to such different conclusions about these artists' works? I'm going to digress for just a moment and give a very abbreviated background on how Truett actually got to the sculpture she was making by 1963. She was born in 1921, Anne Dean. She was born in Baltimore but grew up on Maryland's eastern shore in the town of Easton with her younger twin sisters and her mother and father. She moved to Asheville, North Carolina as a teenager. That was because her parents were voluntarily being treated at the Highland Hospital, which was a progressive mental health facility there. And then she went on to Bryn Mawr College in 1938, where she earned her undergraduate degree in psychology. By 1944, she was working at Massachusetts General Hospital, both in the psychiatric lab as a nurse's aide and in both of those capacities, she came into contact with patients who had fought in World War II. In 1946, she felt confronted by the limitations of psychology and turned to writing fiction, mainly short stories grounded in the present and past episodes of her life. She then became frustrated with the conventions of linear narrative and its inability to express the complexities of experience and time. By 1948, in fact, she was living in Washington, D.C. with her then husband, James Truett. This frustration she was feeling with writing gave way to the realization that visual art offered a different way of expressing time, and she enrolled in Washington's Institute of Contemporary Art, where she met Kenneth Nolan, who in turn introduced her to Morris Lewis, both of them, of course, abstract painters at work here in Washington. And throughout the late 1940s and 50s, she made sculpture that explored material qualities, working with cast cement, clay, marble, and also carving wood. And on your left, you see an undocumented work that's in a private collection that very likely dates to this time. I haven't been able to examine this piece in person, but I can say that this piece is very much in the same vein as other works made by the artists that have been photographically documented and dated to the period. Truett intentionally destroyed most of her early work that remained in her hands after she made that turn to abstraction. She destroyed the work around 1962. Also during the 1950s and up through the early 60s, she participated in the social world of Washington, entertaining political figures and journalists. Her husband, James, was a prominent journalist. And cultural figures such as Isamu Noguchi, Marcel Duchamp, David Sylvester, and Clement Greenberg. Indeed, Greenberg became a close friend of the Truett's family. And I'll just say here that the amount of influence that Greenberg, as the most prominent modernist critic of the day, had on Truett and the reception of her work is a topic that bears a great deal more attention than I can give it tonight. But it is certainly something to keep in mind as one considers Truett's position in the critical discourse that developed around minimalism, a discourse that displaced Greenberg's own centrality to the shaping of contemporary art after the 1960s. So then, in 1961, Truett made a radical leap from figuration built from various materials to sculpture that explored geometric and color relationships through painted wood elements. As indicated by its title, you see literally the first of these works on your right. Skipped one. I'm just including these two images of works by Clifford Still, both in the Hirshhorn's collection, to give you a sense of another artist's progression from representation to abstraction. And because I think it's curious to see how the earlier works by Still and Truett seem to share a kind of understanding about extracting the human form in a way that is somewhat, one can say, psychological, surreal, we might be tempted to use the word primitive, despite the 10 to 15 years that separate them. But then on the other hand, the two artists' more developed notions of abstraction, separated by a similar dozen-year span, are radically different. Again, suggesting that the abstract forms at which Truett and Judd individually arrived by the early 1960s are more similar than dissimilar. First, first was created after Truett saw the American Abstract Expressionist and Imagist exhibition at the Guggenheim in November of 1961. This was a show that included paintings by Noland and Lewis, Truett's friends and colleagues back in Washington. But Truett left most impressed by the shift in values of the blacks and Ad Reinhardt's paintings, as well as, this is a quote from her, the universe of blue paint that she saw in a Barnett Newman painting from 1953, which you see on the screen. In this comparison, then, it appears that rather than still, it is more Newman's version of abstract expressionism that has a stronger visual kinship with Truett's maturing abstraction. Also, in terms of what comes before Truett art historically, and now specifically looking to sculpture, one might think about connections to the work of David Smith, who by 1960 was a social acquaintance of Truett's, and someone with whom she discussed the nature of being an artist. For instance, she recalled that it was David Smith who taught her how to sign her work. It was Smith, along with Kenneth Nolan and Clement Greenberg, that encouraged the dealer Andre Emmerich to visit Truett's studio in 1962, while Emmerich was in Washington for Morris Lewis's funeral. And that is a visit that led to her first New York solo show at the Emmerich Gallery. Smith, of course, was an artist that Greenberg championed. Just as Greenberg advocated that painting necessarily explore its own medium, that it investigate how paint is or can be applied to the two-dimensional ground that supports it, he felt that sculpture was about, or properly about, the relationship of its constituent parts and how the eye optically related one to the other. Sculpture might then be seen as something rooted in the eye and not the body, with operations that were entirely distinct from those of painting. You can see that Truett's first reflects some of these qualities. Chiefly, it is an investigation of the way that a number of three-dimensional forms relate to each other within a whole, and yet it quite prominently involves a painted surface. All this is really to say that Truett's arrival at the vocabulary of minimal abstraction in 1961 was in no way ill-informed or ungrounded in the language of abstraction that preceded it. If there is a distinction to be made between Truett and Judd's minimalism, we can say it isn't a matter of Truett's naivete or lack of sophistication with regard to the art that came before hers, nor can we dismiss or diminish the insights and innovations that Truett's initial sculptures in 61, 62, and 63 brought to the trajectory of abstraction in America. And just as a reference point, keep in mind that of the two artists, Truett had the first New York solo show in February 1963. Judd's followed in December of the same year. There we go again. So rather, I feel the significant difference between the artists is the degree to which Truett inflected her reduced abstraction with personal experience and emotion, while Judd purged his sculpture, or more to the point, purged the discourse around his sculpture from personal elements, whether that be emotional expressiveness or biographical illusion. Other differences between the artists can be incorporated into this broader point. For instance, that Truett would continue to paint her sculpture, hand paint her sculpture, leaving the works or the marks of her brush and her touch visible on its surface, while Judd would have his completely fabricated, eliminating the personal touch of the artist. And also that Truett's work merged the disciplines of painting and sculpture, using a 3D armature to deploy hand-mixed colors to expressive effect, while Judd worked with the volumes and voids of a more purely sculptural and material vocabulary. So now to give you a sense of the personal or biographical grounding of Truett's work. Remember, we've been looking at a shape that recalls a fence, and quite specifically, according to Truett, the fences that define the town of Easton on the eastern shore in which she grew up. Here you see a variety of contemporary images from those places, including a fence near the Hewlett-Henry House, where the Dean family lived, starting in 1928 and into the early 1930s. You also see the Quaker Meeting House of Easton with its distinctive roof line, and the 18th century home in the lower right, called Genesar, which was a property that actually belonged to the ancestors of Truett's husband, James, but which she had known earlier in her life. The geometry at work in this architecture is striking. You note the severe and clear contours, as well as the painted wood board construction of the meeting house. These structures contain strong horizontal and vertical elements, as well as at times dramatic diagonals. Important, too, is that Truitt's first mature work is clearly a reference to offense, while her second sculpture, Southern Elegy, from 1962, depicts a grave marker. Both fences and headstones are markers of place and significance in literal and metaphorical ways. They delineate position in a way that can be profound, poetic, and open-ended, as they suggest an individual's relationship to the inside and outside, to inclusion and exclusion, separation and reunion, and ultimately to different zones or states of existence. Here I've introduced an image of the graves that are actually on the side yard of the Quaker Meeting House. So I hope by way of this comparison, you can start to see that Truitt's work from 1962 and 1963 is essentially populated with a town's worth of forms. Even when the work becomes more and more abstract, the same character of the Eastern Shore's architecture emerges. For those of you who have seen the show, remember that the Arundel paintings in the background of this image contain fine lines of graphite that describe horizontals, verticals, and the diagonals that had actually ended up disappearing from Truitt's sculptures by the late 1960s. Now, just as Truitt described her Arundel paintings as representing the forces that happen in the intervals between people and occurrences, I want to underscore that inextricably linked to the architectural shapes and structures of Truitt's physical life experiences are the events or dynamics of her biography. And it is both the form and content of her life that merge in her sculpture. It is telling that when the artist chose to publish a verbal account of her artistic practice, she chose the form of an autobiographical journal, publishing not one but three book-length accounts of her life. Although in these books, Daybook, Turn, and Prospect, she did not explicate precisely or literally how her life events were transfigured into her artworks, based on other correspondence, interviews, and recordings which the artist left behind, as well as the careful observation of her art itself and her published words, a student of Truitt's art can begin to decode the work through the lens of biography. While this isn't something that's necessary to the visual appreciation of the work, just as it isn't necessary to understand every allusion in a poem to appreciate its meter and juxtaposition of words, I do feel the contemplation of Truitt's abstraction within the context of her life gives us a richer sense of abstraction's capacity to carry profound meaning and allows us to make a more human connection to the artist and the work she produced. To give an example, first, with its irregularly shaped and spaced pickets, you need to look closely at the sculpture, and it's not necessarily clear in the slide, but the spacing between each of those pickets varies, just as the topmost peaks meet in different ways in each of the three elements. I believe a sculpture not only sort of suggests formal sculptural relationships in a David Smithian way, but I think it also offers another layer of insight into what we could call the psychological or emotional relationships between separate entities or personalities, such as those found in a family, consider those of Truitt and her younger twin siblings, or perhaps even one could speculate among Truitt's three children. It's interesting that Sam, Truitt's third and last child, was born in November 1960, almost precisely a year before she made her trip to the Guggenheim and returned to make first, an image of three similar but distinctly different elements that, despite their separation, will always be bound together, truly a moving family of forms. Coming back to Judd and Truitt then, we see that while Truitt's sculptures participate in a similar formal discourse with those of Judd, their conceptual trajectories diverge. It is almost as if Judd's investigation of the manufacturing of sculptural form and its relationship to a human body's physical position demands to be experienced entirely in the present, while Truitt's distills or compresses the flux of life experience, specifically her life experience, into a fixed artifact. Now that I've hopefully made some headway in outlining both the objective similarities between the objects produced by Truitt and Judd and the conceptual differences between their overriding projects or practices as artists, I would like to introduce some comparisons that are intended to provoke a bit and that are very much offered in the spirit of this talk, serving as a thought exercise. First, take a look at Truett's work next to that of Piero della Francesca, an artist she admired, having learned about his work while an undergraduate at Bryn Mawr, and which she finally saw in person during a trip to Europe in 1984. In Piero's work, the vertical columnar form is not only the organizing principle for architectural structure, but also for the human figure. And I think in this, as well as his work's lucidity of color and classical refinement, there is an affinity to the work of Truett. Now, consider a comparison with the work of painter and illustrator Maxfield Parrish, known in part because of the popularity of his images on posters and calendars. During the course of my interviewing friends and acquaintances of Truett, and amidst their characterizations of her as a consummate intellectual, it was also revealed that Truett enjoyed the work of Parrish. Now, I have no interest in pursuing a comparative study of Truett and Parrish, nor do I desire to attempt to trace a line of influence from the earlier to the later artist. Although, just as in the juxtaposition with Piero's Annunciation, can't we find grounds for similarity here? There seems to be an interest in illumination, the common interest in radiant color, and skyward reaching verticality. But rather, the point that I want to make is about hierarchies of art and the particular vulnerability of abstraction to being placed in generalizing and hierarchical categories. There is a lot of room to argue the difference between Piero and the Parrish based on the subjects depicted, but the evaluation of non-objective images pushes us to probe the issue of hierarchy further. Isn't it interesting how the juxtaposition of Truett's work with one image or another casts our reception of the work toward either the extremes of irrational classicism or romantic kitsch, to use the word that Clement Greenberg chose to designate inferior types of artistic output in his landmark 1939 essay, Avant-Garde and Kitsch. Comparing the two works, one might note that Piero's body's architecture and the narrative encompassing them have a certain clarity and coherence that is intertwined with religious authority and legitimacy. Parrish's romanticized central bodies suggest a dreamy, intimate, and presumably less noble fantasy. Piero's painting convincingly represents a collective myth, while Parrish seductively portrays a personal reverie. The religiosity of Piero's image gives way to a supernatural space in Parrish's, with all the corresponding distinctions between high mass and a magic show. Looking at Truett and Judd's work from the vantage point of 2009, and knowing that each artist apparently simultaneously, and I think based on the available evidence that one can't say that either Judd or Truett is derivative of the other. So looking at it from now, and knowing that each artist arrived at their minimal vocabulary, I would like to hear someone develop a convincing and compelling argument that painted rectilinear sculpture can be evaluated, that is placed in a hierarchy, on visual objective qualities alone, according to whether it is monochrome or polychrome, whether the painted composition adheres to or diverts from the geometry of its infrastructure, whether the applied color is primary mixed or mixed, whether a surface that is understood as essentially smooth is better or worse because it was created with a brush and a sander operated by hand or mechanically. Today, stripping down the argument to what is inherent in the basic composition of these non-objective images, that the nature of the surface color would make one box superior to another, essentially because cadmium red is better than reddish brown, makes art criticism either seem so petty or so esoteric that it is irrelevant to larger concerns of life. But I don't believe the art world system of evaluation is essentially empty and arbitrary. I feel that there is something else at stake. By the way, as I was thinking through this, the only compelling argument that I can imagine that would tie hierarchical evaluation of abstraction to purely visual qualities is one that presumes a universally embraced standard of aesthetic beauty, and that beauty being a superior condition. And this is a presumption I think that is very much open to debate, but even if it wasn't, my intuition is that an art criticism in history organized around the idea of beauty would deem Truett the more important of the two artists, between Truett and Judd. So let's consider an aspect of the distinction between the Piero and Parrish that extends beyond the particularities of the physical composition of their images, the premise that art that is more openly personal and less about collectively accepted narratives and agendas is somehow the inferior art. Just as Piero's art was deployed within the discourse of Catholicism, Judd's sculpture came to be ensconced in the canon of minimalism. In this sense, both artists' work invite and encourage a particular society of interested individuals and support its corresponding system of belief and values. Piero's image reinforces a social network of people whose economic livelihood and political standing alongside their faith required the perpetuating of a certain interpretation and dissemination of the narratives of Christianity. Judd's art and writing in the early 1960s were critical to the developing narrative of minimalism, which, like Catholicism, has tenets that need to be preserved by the means of inclusion and exclusion in order to define a particular social group of artists, dealers, critics, curators, and collectors, and cement the economic and power relationships that define it. And, of course, in the name of full disclosure, I'm well aware of how these societies operate because I'm a participant in a contemporary iteration of one. In this scheme, the illustrator Parrish fails to fit into the category of high art because his output has such popular appeal. It doesn't even need to enter into a situation of mutual dependence with a group of interested and initiated individuals. It operates on a personally legible level to its beholders, circulating directly to a wide audience without needing a small society of interpreters who benefit from their role as middlemen. Truitt's work, or rather her approach to positioning her work, could be seen as equally flummoxing to the middlemen, the Society of Art Initiates. Although in her case, the work is exceptionally personal to its maker rather than to its audience. It is an antisocial counterpart to Parrish's popularism. Truitt was understandably unwilling to let her work be interpreted as either minimalist or as related to the Washington Color School of Noland and Lewis, wanting to emphasize how it was distinct from those categories rather than how it was similar. At the same time, she resisted explicating the very references behind her work that she pointed to as among the primary reasons for its distinctiveness. And then again, as I've mentioned, she went on to publish 3 autobiographical journals of her life as an artist, which do everything to suggest that her life and art were entwined, short of decoding the works and letting us glimpse into the mental mechanics of her minimalism. As an aside, it's also perhaps significant that, as with the circulation of Parrish's posters and calendars, Truitt's published books were written and published in a way that her story was disseminated directly to a wider audience. And that wider public was composed largely of people wanting to develop themselves as creative individuals within the mundane demands of their lives. This sort of situation, I think, kind of pushes those people, the art initiates, the already arrived, out of the picture of interpreting Truitt's work. Likewise, Truitt was adamant about not wanting her work to be considered gendered, and she did not embrace the notion of feminism as an artistic movement that was relevant to her work. Again, her position is not without cause or logic. One has only to think of Donald Judd's or Clement Greenberg's writing on Truitt's art in the 1960s to shudder at the overt sexism that colored their analyses, the former critical and the latter marginally supportive, and to appreciate Truitt's desire to separate gender from the interpretation of her artwork. Nevertheless, her published journal suggests the struggle of an artist who also found herself in the gendered roles of mother and wife. Further, Truitt enforced a veil of privacy around her studio practice as well as the Eastern spiritual path she came to follow by the early 1970s. Again, she dropped hints about the spiritual dimensions of her work in her published journals, but she made it difficult for anyone really to develop a discourse around it. And here tonight, rather than skirt around this issue, I do want to address it a little bit head on, not go into detail, but I would just want to suggest that if there is a quality of popular mysticism that the intelligentsia finds distasteful in the work of Parrish, then perhaps it's the sort of aloof and again personal mystery in metaphysics and Truitt's art that I think the art elite of the second half of the 20th century has found suspect or at least uncomfortable. And so, because of what might be construed by some as Truett's series of mixed messages, or considered by others as a strategy, a careful strategy, to avoid categorization, whether that be in such ascendant categories as minimalism or feminism, or the pejorative categories of feminine or metaphysical abstraction, it has not been easy for a society of self-interested supporters and interpreters to articulate a discourse and develop a market around her work. And consequently, I would argue it has been marginalized, as more discursive works, like Judd's, have been given pride of place in the formation of the history of abstraction over the last five decades. And I use discursive here both in the sense of being congenial to discourse and in the sense of proceeding by way of reason rather than intuition. So there's a self-perpetuating cycle at work, where no one writes about the work, and that feeds into no one showing the work, and then again, no one buys the work, and then no one sees the work, and it just feeds again, it feeds on itself, it just continues. So ultimately, the sphere of influence of such art doesn't grow. I don't think it's an accident that this current Truett retrospective occurred in Washington, where the artist lived, and where there has been a local base of collectors and friends with personal ties to Truett. In fact, the other major museum shows of her art were also organized by curators based in the Baltimore, Washington area. The at that time DC-based Walter Hopps organizing the 1973 and 74 Whitney and Corcoran retrospectives, and Brenda Richardson organizing a show in 1992 at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And I would also observe that if there is a kind of society of supporters around Truett, its most ardent participants are those who were her students. So there is the community of her classroom there, but as with her journals, Truett firmly stands as the authority figure in that community, controlling the discourse. So there hasn't been room or much incentive for outsiders seeking standing and profit to invest their time in trying to add their take to the discussion. One wonders now what the future holds in terms of securing broader recognition about the work, and I do not hazard a prediction. Certainly, one must acknowledge the important work of recent scholars and curators like James Meyer and Anne Goldstein, who have questioned the discourse of minimalism as it has evolved since the 1960s and created much welcome space to reevaluate the contributions of artists like Truett. And I do think the fact that a prominent New York commercial gallery has recently started to work and represent the Truett estate will have an impact on the narratives that form around the work in the future, and that will be very interesting to watch. Perhaps it's illuminating at this moment to jump from Judd to a contemporary incarnation of minimal abstraction. Byron Kim's Congregation of Flesh-Colored Rectangles interests me in relationship to Truett because, as with Truett's art, there is something of a person in the image and its making. The colors of Kim's rectangles are derived from the skin tones of actual people. They are portraits of personhood by way of its prismatic properties of human skin. In short, where with Judd the human body is something that is outside of the objects he produced but interacts with them, here, as with Truett, humanity is in the image that the artist has crafted. Personal experience, both in the sense of the artist's individual experience and the artist's experience of individuals, guides the formal choices that manifest in the image. Kim's work also shares the quality that Truett's in that it demonstrates potentially infinite variation within a certain signature style or motif of the artist. This, I think, is best explicated with Truett's series of dryad sculptures, the four works at the left of this slide, in the columns that she designated spring dryad, summer dryad, autumn dryad, and winter dryad. There are both essentially monochromatic compositions with slim horizontal bands capping or grounding the forms, and compositions defined by vertical bands of color. And you see that a little bit better in this image. And these are motifs that repeat throughout Truett's work. Interestingly, Truett was a student of Proust's In Search of Lost Time, seeing it as exemplary of the way that art and life inform one another, with Proust's narrator unflinchingly capturing every detail of the world around him, as well as the dynamics of how emotion, expectation, and memory color objective understanding. Proust created a work in which we marvel at the ambition and specificity of the world his narrator creates, all the while finding aspects of ourselves in his particular experience. I would also posit that Truett saw Proust's writing as a model of how different states of time, the past, the present, and future, can collapse into a unitary body of an artwork. In the fifth volume of Proust's epic, its narrator tells of hearing a new musical composition by a familiar composer and responding to the particular aspects of that piece of new music, which, despite his never having heard the composition before, for him identify the work as uniquely that of the composer. The narrator explains that these aspects or motifs repeat in different combinations throughout the composer's oeuvre, and he calls them the dryads. I believe that, at least in part, this is the reference that lends its name to Truett's series of sculptures. For certainly, the four works reveal the motifs that repeat throughout Truett's work and can be recognized as a kind of unique signature of her as an artist. With Kim, his dryad is the translucent oil and wax surface that define his explorations of the hues of numerous individuals, objects, and experiences, ranging from these flesh tones to the variations of green in Asian ceramics. But again, while there are striking similarities between the artist's work, I come back to the discursive differences that continue to matter so much to contemporary art. Byron Kim's piece, despite the complexity of the human animal, funnels the representation of personhood down through a highly rational process to the color of an individual's skin, coating the serially repeated form of a rectangular panel of wood. In other words, he has made his signifier unambiguous and therefore reassuring, especially to the society of collectors, critics, curators, fellow artists, and students of contemporary art, who all would be well aware of the legacy of minimalism, and who by and large share the socio-political value of aspiring to a culture living in racial harmony. And let me say that just because something is unambiguous or reflective of a clique's value system doesn't mean it isn't positive or worthy. The social bonds of Kim's artwork to its particular art world in-crowd is made even more firm when we learn, to quote Blake Gopnik's Washington Post review, that one dark chocolate brown rectangle of the grid depicts the skin tone of the well-known African-American artist Lorna Simpson, or that the late Marcia Tucker, founder of the New Museum in New York, is a pale beige. Kim's piece doesn't just speak to the ascendant forces of the contemporary art world, it depicts them. On the other hand, we have Truett. I'd like to read a passage from Daybook. The other afternoon, when I was entertaining my daughter Mary in her bath, she asked me whether I thought artists were just born that way. I said I thought they might be. How, she asked. I said I didn't know, but that there was rarely a time when I wasn't half consciously translating what was around me into terms of art, that as I stood at the door, for I was on my way out when this exchange took place, I had been absorbing her brown body against the white tub, the yellow top of the nail brush, the dark green shampoo bottles, Sam's blue towel, her orange towel, and could make a sculpture called Mary in the Tub if I ever chose to. These elements arranged themselves into proportions of color, the weights of which gave me the meaning of what I was seeing. Mary and I laughed, partly out of the pleasure of talking with one another, and partly out of wry recognition of everyone's oddness. It strikes me that as compared to Byron Kim's or Donald Judd's formulations or formulas of abstraction, the process described here by Truett is exceptionally idiosyncratic. And once again, the word that remains so difficult for some in the art world to swallow, personal. Personal not only in the sense that every color of Truett's hypothetical sculpture would harken back to a source unknown to the majority of its audience, but that those sources are intimately connected to the artist's domestic situation. Mary and Sam are her children, her home, and, if you will, a very particular and individual instance of that experience, which is motherhood. In a sense, sentiment has interfered with the minimalist equation. Even in her use of a seemingly ordinary fence in her sculpture First, Truett's aesthetics are not those of a detached Duchampian, appropriating and recontextualizing the shapes and colors of the mundane world as an instrument of theory, but of someone attuned to the perceptible manifestations and translations of the complicated range of life's activities, events, relationships, and emotions. Despite the politics of Kim's picture, Truitt's approach to minimal form seems far less neutral and more insistent on being taken on its own terms, and consequently, far more unruly in terms of taking a defined place within art history. I think then we can conclude that in comparison to other examples of minimal or reduced geometric abstraction that have found more widespread critical response and acceptance throughout the history of late 20th century art, Truitt's project was characterized by a kind of determined yet obscured personalization. She sought to separate emotions and memories from the context of her life and make them available in a more universal way, all the while preserving the specificity that quite literally gave each experience individual color and composition. That's not an easy project to accomplish in our world. I would argue that it is this specificity that makes Truitt's work succeed as art, even if it hasn't always succeeded as a subject of discourse and as commodity. And I will look forward to future students of American abstraction, free from residual 20th century critical prejudices, probing much further into the nature of the melding of personal biographical experience and universal form, so tenaciously preserved in Truitt's oeuvre and at such cost. In fact, I hope they form a whole new discursive society invested in doing so. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.